very kind of Dan. I do remember talking. I'd stopped reading comics. I read comics when I was a little, when I was about 12, and then I thought, oh, I'm grown up now, and I stopped reading them. And then I actually started reading the Hulk again when Dan was reading it in the bar, and I was 2 years younger than him. And I thought, wow, an adult's reading this. And and it was going a particularly good phase, the Peter David phase. And then about 2 years later, I was still here. In 1989, I was in the third year. I went down to Honey's newsagent, and there was a Marvel comic called The Knights of Pendragon, in which loads of forgotten characters from 70s Marvel comics were involved in a quest in modern-day Britain to find the Holy Grail, I think. And I remember reading through it and noticing that loads of the dialogue was derived from Gawain and the Green Knight, and specifically from the translation that had been passed round this college. And so Dan had made it. And I keep noticing over the years things that Dan's done. Most recently, my little boy is a big Scooby-Doo fan, and I bought him a book of Scooby-Doo comics, and one of them I was reading to him. And he's 28 years old, my son. No, he's four. And one of them I was reading to him, and it was set backstage at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the Scooby-Doo gang were involved in a mystery involving various Shakespeare plays, and I was thinking, some of the jokes in this are really funny, and it's really good, and it's got an incredible working knowledge of Shakespeare. Who wrote this? And it was Dan Abnett. And I looked at the credit. I got in touch with Dan for the first time for years, and said, I've been reading one of your Scooby-Doo comics, and it was much better than it was necessary for it to be. And he said, can I use that as a quote? But when I was pleased that Dan was doing the day when Lucy had asked us to come, because I looked at the spread of people, and there were a lot of people on it that were poets, academics, respected novelists, literary critics, and then there were also going right through to people like Samir Ahmed, who was talking about pitching for documentaries, people that write genre fiction like Chick Lit, Lawrence Davey wrote a lot of television drama, and me. And I think that the spread on the day was such that some people were very comfortable with the idea that what they did was worthwhile, and others of us, I felt, had to sort of justify the position, saying that what we did have some merit as literature, or it had some relationship to what we'd studied. And I think that over the course of the day, it was quite interesting. It's funny that Lucy wants to get us to do these two talks again, because there's that old Zen saying you can't step back into the same river twice. And the atmosphere of the day, as it went through, was quite interesting. Particularly, there was a point where, in the middle of the afternoon, where Lawrence Davey, who writes scripts for TV cop dramas, asked quite an aggressive question about the mechanics of writing. Because obviously, like Dan and myself, to a point, he has to work out how to fit what he wants to do into established rules, whether it's TV, drama, comic books, or the sort of conventions of stand-up and comedy. And there was a little chat, a bit of a frisson there, I think it was fair to say. And so when I came out to do my talk, which is at the end of the day, I had a disproportionate level of feeling that I had some point to make, which is not the case today, because the atmosphere is very different. But I am going to read it as I wrote it for then. Even though, and I haven't looked at this since then, so it's just like, this is like the sealed knot when they try and recreate a Civil War battle, hasn't it? So, you've got to think it was a Friday, it was a whole spread of all sorts of people, and it came at the end of that. So I'll just do it like that, and say, anyway, basically I've been a stand-up for going on 25 years now. I've done lots of other little things. I wrote a not very good novel in the 90s, which I was very lucky to get published, and which I've managed to suppress the republication of. I've written lots of radio comedy, two or three dramas for stage, and words for libretto for a funny opera and various other things. But the thing that I've reluctantly accepted, principally, is the main source of my income and the main use of my time is stand-up, and that's the thing that I'm happiest doing. So this is what I said in February, the lost talk, that was probably, may have been a reason why it was lost. We've heard a lot of talk today, that was back then, remember? This so doesn't make sense now. We've heard a lot of talk today about writing, I expect. I don't know. I wrote this on the train at 8 a.m. this morning, so I didn't know at the time exactly what would be said later. Back then. But I thought it was reasonable to expect that we would have heard a lot of talk today about writing, about the well-tuned phrase, the appropriate simile, the perfectly constructed plot, all elements of the writer's craft that may leave an audience member or a reader breathless with admiration for the writer's writerly writing. But as a stand-up comedian, I work in an area where many listeners, critics, and practitioners still assume there's no writing involved. And it's funny, looking back at this now, I can see that I was desperately trying to justify myself to people that I thought were better than me at the writer's day, which has been going on for years now. And that's because if the writing process is at all noticeable in stand-up, then it may be assumed that the comedian is in some way failed. Now, Messiaen maintained that he wrote music with the voices of the birds. The futurists and the vorticists wrote poems that aimed to echo the violent energy of contemporary warfare and industry. And like a lot of stand-ups, I tried to write in the rhythms of cadences of someone who has cornered you in a bar or a train carriage, continues drinking steadily and determinedly over a two-hour period, grows increasingly agitated and unhappy whilst holding forth on a series of subjects he really knows little about. And in so doing, inadvertently reveals some great truth and or the real things that are driving him to despair. And since I left college in the 1980s, as you can see, I've spent a lot of time researching this method. Now, nobody laughs at anyone they feel is trying too hard to entertain them. And the key to stand-up for me, I find, is that it should sound as if it hasn't been written. And often the best way to make a piece of writing sound as if it hasn't been written is not to actually write it at all. And I realise this made my position on the writer's day very tenuous. Before considering stand-up comedy as writing or non-writing, it's necessary to define some terms, a bit like Dan was talking about the difference between American and British models. They are quite different. I'm going to concentrate mainly on the British model, ignoring the often superior American version and referring to it only in order to disparage it. So until the late 70s, no one in Britain would ever have considered a stand-up comedian to be a writer. And with one or two exceptions, perhaps Dave Allen, Les Dawson, this was largely correct. There were a number of different models in operation, few of them involving writing as such. The club comics of the working men's club circuit, it doesn't really exist anymore, would dress up smartly in suits and bow ties and tell one-liners from a shared collective pool of thousands of jokes, admittedly in different regional accents. And these jokes seemed to belong to a kind of tacitly understood folk archive, like wise sayings about the weather or broadsheet newspaper opinions. Everyone owned them, no one claimed to have written or invented any of them, and indeed attempting to establish ownership over one of those jokes would have been considered extremely bad form. And in fact, there was a weird crossover when I was starting to do the circuit in the 80s where you'd still sometimes meet comics from that school, and if they saw you do a joke and they liked it, they go, I like that one you did about so-and-so, I'll have that. And it wasn't even considered that you'd complain about that. It was just sort of understood that you couldn't own a joke. And when, there was a program in the 70s called The Comedians that filmed all these kind of acts. They filmed them in succession in front of studio audiences. But the fact that they were all doing the same material meant they had to put a blackboard up at the side of the stage, off stage, where an assistant would cross off the jokes that had been done for the benefit of acts further up the bill. So that was how similar it all was. And when the so-called alternative comedians of the 70s wanted to generate a new kind of stand-up comedy to write about contemporary politics or even just to write at all, they had to look to the pre-existing American model. And most of the significant pioneers of stand-up in Britain in the late 70s and early 80s, who encouraged the idea that the comedian could be some kind of writer-artist, as people like Tony Allen or Jerry Sadovitz or Alexei Sayle, who's just started again, they looked to the American stand-ups of the 50s for inspiration, particularly Lenny Bruce, who, in the late 70s, Tony Allen had a great opening line, and it was this. Lenny Bruce ended his career high on drugs, surrounded by police, vomiting into a toilet bowl. Well, that's how mine began. But as well as being a funny line, which got a much better laugh with on the writer's day than it has today. I don't know why that was. Perhaps because there were a lot of older people here and they related more to that. Or perhaps older people, you know, I'm not saying young people today are square, but there you are. But as well as being funny, it's iconoclastic. It makes fun of a character who was already becoming part, makes fun of Lenny Bruce, who was already becoming part of the canon, and whose death under mysterious circumstances had confirmed the kind of sainthood on him. And it also places Tony Allen, the man telling that joke, as part of an American tradition, where the comedian was a dangerous sort of decadent thinker, artist figure, rather than a man in a bow tie making fun of racial minorities before a raffle in a pub. Which was kind of the British equivalent at the time. And in the 50s and 60s in America, Lenny Bruce's material was obviously written by him. It wasn't borrowed, it was in his own Jewish hipster idiom, and it was from his own experiences, and it ranged around covering subjects for which there was no pre-existing pool of material to steal from. The civil rights movement, homosexuality, drugs, philosophy, history, and it was conversational in style, it wasn't locked into the rhythms of gags. In the 1950s, American nightclubs, lots of comics were still emphasising their punchlines with percussion. You could get the house band to do a cymbal crash after your joke. The most famous and economic example of this is Henny Youngman. He had that used the following line, which sounds like it's about to begin a sort of discursive bit, but it's just this. It goes, "Take my wife, please." Cymbal crash, bang. A great little neat thing. That thing reduced to its most economic form. But there wasn't anywhere you could put those cymbal crashes into Lenny Bruce's material. And he's got a bit from 1961. It's 2.5 minutes long. You can probably find it on iTunes. It's called "To is a Preposition, Come is a Verb." And he explores anxieties about sexual language by using the verb to come in as many different ways as possible. But throughout it, he's banging on a cymbal and other bits of the percussion kit that would have been at the back of the stage, as if signifying to you that he's moving away from jokes where you could bang a cymbal or a snare drum at the end, away from moments of sudden impact and into a more writer-driven model where we had to consider the impact of lines as a whole in context and then decide whether we found the whole piece funny rather than just individual bits. And so for British acts trying to make stand-up a writerly concern in the 70s and the early 80s, the Thatcher government was also an unexpected catalyst. I think whenever you talk about any kind of writing, you very quickly can't get away from economics and politics. In the post-war era, the now unfashionable belief that culture was socially redemptive and beneficial, which not even the culture minister seems to agree with anymore, the idea that culture was for everyone, irrespective of its ultimate financial value, meant there was funding for a sort of mushrooming national network of arts labs and arts centres where state-subsidised theatre groups could tour and develop original work. But because of the cuts under the Thatcher government to these sorts of things, this arguably unsustainable model began to fall away in the 80s, at roughly the point where the writer-driven alternative comedy movement took off. I get to see really interesting places going around the country doing art centres. And one of my favourites is Darlington Art Centre up north. At the back of the stage, there's a spiral staircase that runs from the full height of the theatre and it's from the dressing rooms up to some administration offices. And the whole poster wall there, which has mercifully never been redecorated for years, is plastered with all the cheaply photocopied promotional posters of shows from the 60s, 70s and 80s. And you can track the progress of alternative comedy, and particularly of specific alternative comedians like Andy de la Tour, John Dowie, Pauline Melville, Jim Barclay, who initially in the 70s are bit players in subsidised left-wing touring theatre groups, and by the 80s are having to take a more cost-effective approach to what they do as the subsidies get cut, where they become one person and a microphone. You can sort of track this with the dates. And so suddenly a generation of people who were used to writing new work called themselves stand-up comedians and were plying their trade out of economic necessity, really, in a country that had no real tradition of the comedian as writer. They found their hands were forced by the economic reality. Then there was a gradual comedy boom of places where three or four acts would do 20-minute sets throughout the 80s and the 90s. But crucially, it also became commonplace for acts to tour one-person shows around what remained of the arts centre and the smaller regional theatre network. And this forced people to write sets that would fill longer show-length slots in these sorts of spaces. And you now have a situation where stand-up comedians can do on stage a 60, a 90, I mean, or even a two-hour show. And in that show, you can do a lot of the things that writers of novels or plays do with narrative and thematic through lines and a not necessarily trustworthy voice at the helm of it. You won't see much of this stuff on television because the structures don't exist to display it, and actually television favours people that work in shorter bursts, really. But there are people out there like Daniel Kitson, Paul Sinner, Josie Long, Phil Nicol, Mark Thomas, Claudia Doherty, that you can see them at the fire station here probably or whatever, doing that kind of work. Oxford's a culturally rich city, but if you go to most of the council-funded theatres that are surviving in towns around the country like King's Lynn or St Albans or Camberley, Aberdeen, Doncaster, Wrexham, the programmes in those places mainly consist of tribute bands playing covers, low-budget revivals of old musicals, hypnotists, mediums, spiritualists, elderly sportsmen reading their reactionary memoirs, and stand-up comedians. And there's not a lot of original work there, weirdly, even though they get some funding for these places. And there was a period when I was touring 4 years ago, and at the same time I noticed the comedians Joe Caulfield and Rod Gilbert, who's quite well known now, were also touring. And our three shows were often the only things in most of the theatre brochures around what you might call the provinces that featured any original writing or any form of social commentary or any significant degree of theatrical practice or literary awareness. And people in these cultural deserts went to see them because they were comedy. And a lot of them probably wouldn't have gone if they'd imagined there was going to be any literary or theatrical ideas at work. This was a bit of a shock to the people here on Writer's Day, but most people hate that kind of thing, or at least they think they do because they're never exposed to it. Stand-up comedy is quite interesting because it can sneak smart stuff past people by stealth, I think. And most of the people watching it, as a rule, don't like to think there's any kind of process at work. They like to believe that ideas are unfolding in the moment. And it's interesting what Dan was saying before about a comic reader. He'd like the idea that they would forget they were reading a comic. I think people watching something like to think that it's happening in real time, that the art form depends on the illusion that a spontaneous two-way dialogue is being engaged in, when in fact a monologue is being performed into which usually predictable interruptions from a largely silent second partner, the audience, can usually be incorporated. And what I do is I can spend a year assembling a two-hour show, which to me is obviously a construct, because it's got dramatic irony, character development as I change over the 2 hours, a beginning, a middle and an end, recurrent themes, an incident at the end that echoes an incident at the beginning, things, you know, the same things being told from different angles that deliberately echo each other, even some bit of set that does something. And people will still come up to me afterwards and say, so I suppose you just go out and make it all up along as you go along, do you? It's really amazing. I don't know if you know Al Murray, the pub landlord, who weirdly was here as well. He did history, but he somehow still managed to become a writer. But he told me he's very, very good at improvising, or at least making it look as if he's improvising. And he told me he got so fed up with people assuming that he'd made the whole thing up as he went along. But he worked a bit into the character where it was necessary for him to recite the whole of the to be or not to be speech from Hamlet. And he said he did that because he wanted to let the audience know that he was capable of learning things, which would then, he hoped, make them realise that there was a process at work rather than that an actual drunk pub landlord had just stumbled out and talked for 2 hours. I've stopped worrying about not getting the credit for writing off comedy audiences, and I've tried to see it as a positive, and I hope things don't sound written. And in the last few years, I've managed to pass off the demands of childcare, increasing tiredness, and a lack of time to write shows as a finished whole up front, and an inability to concentrate or learn or remember blocks of text as positive creative choices. I've switched my view that the strengths of the art form of stand-up, I've changed it to depend on my own personal deficiencies. As far as stand-up's concerned, I used to be a writer for 20 years. I hoped I was like a writer, but I'm not now. So I shouldn't have been on that day last February at all. Before I had kids, I used to assemble 60 or 90 minute shows at my laptop. I'd gradually work out bits that would fit together. Before that, it was on an Amstrad word processor. Before that, it was on a typewriter with a correction ribbon. And then I would learn the whole thing and launch it as a finished piece. And of course, editing would occur in the performance, and the piece would improve in performance over 30 shows, 50 shows, 100 shows, whatever. But looking at the shows that I've written in the last 5 years, if I look at something from 6 or 7 years ago, it seems quite showy and self-conscious and overwritten, like someone trying to show off how clever they are by virtue of the sentences they've written and the words they've used. And if I do that now, I do it self-consciously to make the person on stage look like they're trying to show off, so they look like flawed and dislikable. And that, now I've got kids, I never have time to finish writing a whole show in one go. And I never seem to be able to think about what the underlying themes of a whole show are. So I book myself into months of short slots in small rooms. That's what I'm doing now. And I'll do that till about September. And I go on with words written on my hands. But you can see the leftovers from Sunday there. And scraps of paper that I feel may be the start of something. And gradually they coalesce. And eventually I'll sort of tape where I am and transcribe it back or do it from memory. And it reads like someone else has written it and I'm editing the work of this other person, which is quite useful. Although I realise that does sound like mental illness. But it's like a form of automatic writing is occurring that I'm not conscious of, and things that I'm interested in are emerging from the notes without me having identified them initially. And the language as well, if you haven't written it, has the fumbling, opaque nature of real speech rather than the precision of prepared notes. And so I begin to assemble a deliberate facsimile of a person's ideas at the point of conception rather than at the point of perfection. And this construct allows the audience to feel that they're part of a process rather than spectators at an exhibition of the sort of clockwork toy going off. And one of the interesting problems I've had with working with other people is when I, for the first series of the BBC Two series I did called Comedy Vehicle, my aim was to have 6 half-hours on the go in my head spinning like plates that I could then do and film for the series. But one of them, I couldn't get it right. It was about economics, and at the time, the economic situation was worsening so quickly I had to keep doing rewrites, and I never got it fluid as a piece of performance. But Armando Iannucci, the producer who was editing it, he would read that one on paper and say it was the best one. And I said, it isn't, it's the worst one. You like it because it reads like a funny magazine article, so you can read it off the page and see where the jokes are. But I kept saying to him, as soon as it comes to be performed, it'll sound really stiff and it'll sound like writing, and it did. And I wasn't, I was glad that I was right, but not pleased that it meant the thing wasn't very good. Underlying this process, of course, are all the things that I've learned about structure and meaning and shifts of tone that I think you're taking implicitly on a course here, for example. And it's all very well to convince yourself. And actually, this is interesting on the day, again, last February, because there was a lot of discussion about whether creative writing should be taught as a subject, and I didn't think it did, because I didn't think it should be, because I think it was better to, like Dan said, know what the rules were and take them in from studying other people. Then you can choose what you do with them. It's all very well to convince yourself you're ignoring rules and due process, but you have to know what they are in the first place before you could avoid them, and even then, they'll always be informing what you'll do. The comedian Simon Munnery has this neat little joke. Many are prepared to suffer for their art, few are prepared to learn how to draw. Again, that went better with the older people. So, that said, I already feel like a relic in what I do. I think the idea of a stand-up as a writer, as a sort of auteur, is already on the way out. And just as those 80s Arts Centre opportunities for long-form solo shows crystallised the ambitions of stand-ups in that era as writers to write long-form pieces, so the lucrative opportunities to fill hours and hours of television with stand-up comedy in little bite-sized bits have pushed the writer, auteur, comedian model aside. Of course, people like Jack Whitehall, Andy Osho, Frankie Boyle and Michael McIntyre all use writers. They don't often admit to it. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes there are these strange credits. You'll see something called program associate, blah, blah, which is a sort of television language for there's a writer, but we're going to give him this name because we want to preserve the idea that the comedian is some kind of hermetically sealed, you're getting this person's individual vision. In fact, weirdly, one of the people in the year below me who was here on the Writers' Day was now doing exactly that for lots of those people. But you can see it that it's there that writers are being used in the shift of tone that you get with these kind of acts where there are often mutually incompatible observations in them, or the point of view seems to shift, it doesn't all add up. You also know it's the case because no one could feel the amount of space that they occupy without assistance. I like to think stand-up comedians who rely heavily on writers will one day be stripped of whatever artistic awards or financial awards they received in their careers, like disgraced drug-taking Tour de France cyclists. But I don't think it's ever going to be an issue. I think it's something an old man like me would worry about. because the marketplace, for better, want of a better word, has changed what my generation and the generation of comics before thought was a given of stand-up comedy, that it was partly a writer's game. It was, or aspired to be, for the first time in the 80s, just when I was getting into it, and what caught that was what caught my generation's attention. And of course, we carried that perception of it through into the 90s, just as the Beatles gave bands of the 60s and 70s the idea that they had to be performer creators too, rather than manufactured singing groups performing material provided by Tin Pan Alley songwriters. And this is an assumption that's also disappeared from popular music as well, as surely as it's disappearing from stand-up. Because we were young then, in the 80s, and it was what we grew up with, we assumed that idea that the comedian was a writer was a norm. But it wasn't. It was a kind of blip. It wasn't true before, and it's not true again now. As well as defining themselves in relation to comedy's immediate past by not being racist, sexist, or homophobic, the alternative comedians in the 80s and the late 70s defined themselves by being writers of their own material. Today, in the post-politically correct era, none of these defining considerations remain especially significant. But the notion of the comedian as a writer has been the last to go. And if I was a teenager wanting to write today, I don't think I'd necessarily look at stand-up comedy and think it was a place where a writer's instincts were going to be needed or required. There's probably some other form that hasn't yet been energised by writers and might benefit from writers' input, and then from the input of writers pretending they were never writing at all. But I'm 44. I'm 45 now. The years are slipping away, aren't they? And I don't know what that form is. I mean, it was interesting hearing Dan talk about video games and people who are on doing the Shakespeare saying the same thing. But just as a kind of postscript, what I came away thinking about from the talk in February, and it affected all the people that had come that were writers differently, was that it's interesting to listen to people talk about the nuts and bolts of writing and how they have ideas and how they solve the problems of the whatever discipline or commercial field they're working in, both of which have their own both of which might have different limitations or advantages. But I think what I came away from the Writer's Day thinking about was you can sort of teach that and you can kind of discuss it, but when people say to me now, how would I get to write for fringe theatre with a view towards getting shows on in professional theatres, or how would I get to write for radio, or how would I get to write stand-up? A lot of the answers are to do with economics and social changes, and things are really different now to when I started out. It was much easier to wing it for a few years in the late 80s and the early 90s while you waited to see if things were working out. There were all sorts of little scams and schemes you could get on. There was a thing under the Thatcher government called the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, which was basically there to massage the unemployment figures. But if you could say you were a writer, you could get slightly more than unemployment benefit and not have to do a job. You wouldn't be told to go and find a job. You get a little bit more than unemployment benefit, and you could obviously use your spare time to try and write. I mean, everyone I knew did that in 1989, 1991. You could claim housing benefit in the summer if you were a student, which meant you could try and do things like go to the Edinburgh Fringe, and it wouldn't cost you as much. The Edinburgh Fringe was a great way. Well, it really opened up social access from all different areas of society to writing and performing in the 70s and 80s, because it was cheap to do. You could sign on while you were up there, you could work cash-in-hand jobs, and it didn't cost you thousands of pounds to put a show on, partly because things like the PR industry didn't exist. Basically, business hadn't found a way of inserting itself for profit into a model that didn't require it, you know. So things were much cheaper. You could kind of get by for a bit without having to suddenly make things pay. Also, we weren't trailing £30,000 debts, which I think... And the rhetoric with which younger people talk about education has very much changed. You know, there was a survey the other week where a very high percentage of students felt they weren't getting value for money in terms of the amount of supervision they had. But value for money didn't kind of come into it in our day, because you felt that it was a privilege to be contributing to the store of knowledge rather than that you'd paid to have your own economic position altered in a beneficial way by your experience of education. But if you treat someone on an arts course as a consumer, then necessarily that changes the attitude they come out of it with. Now, all these things have an effect on how would you begin trying to be a writer when that attitude's been instilled into you, and also when the economics of trying to do it are much, much more difficult. People say to me, well, that you're out of the loop, and that YouTube's been a really good way for people getting noticed. Again, I don't know if I agree with that. I think that you're being asked to create things in one particular format to maybe try and get work in another one. And although Dan was talking earlier on about adapting characters from video games into strips or whatever, I find it very difficult personally to... I don't have the ability to think of content cross-platforming. And I wrote a book for Faber, which they suddenly wanted to re-envisage as an app. And I had to say to them... It was going to be Faber's second app. Faber's first app was Of the Wasteland. And it was a major breakthrough for them. Faber's The Wasteland app was the first app that sold to ABC Ones. That's advertiser speak for clever people. And not necessarily people with money, but people that might be interested in literature or whatever. And suddenly there were people thinking, how can we work this untapped market of people? So they wanted me to do my book as an app. And I had to say to the woman, well, the only app I've ever seen, I didn't know what apps were, I haven't got that kind of phone. I don't even know what an app, I know it's supposed to go on iPads, but I haven't got one. So I don't know what an app is. The only app I'd seen at the time was I'd been in an Indian restaurant with some friends, and one of them had an app on his phone. The first app I ever saw was an app where when you went to the toilet, you put in that you were on the toilet, and a map came up of all the other people with this app in the world and where they were on the toilet. And then, so I'd seen that app, and the only other app I've seen is Faber's app of The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. So I didn't know if it was a good app, The Wasteland, really, because I'd only got the I'm on the toilet app to compare it with, so I didn't really know. But I said to them, well, I don't want to make an app, because the book, I wrote the book, it's got three different voices in it. It's got transcripts of the stand-up. It's got me commenting as if I had academic pretensions on the stand-up. And then there are footnotes, which are a kind of other part of me trying to undermine me with academic pretensions. And I didn't know what the app equivalent of that would be. And I didn't, but that sort of, but the idea now, I think, is that you develop once. I took another script to some people I wanted to get made into something, and they said, go away and develop these characters as avatars for the internet. And then if they take off there, I didn't even understand what that was. And so actually Alan Moore said a good thing to me about exactly that, which was that all these things may be ways of doing things. I don't understand them, and it was much simpler 25 years ago, because the thing you were writing it for the format that it was. Alan Moore, someone at the BBC, when the BBC were trying to take over the internet, rang me up and said, we're trying to develop a thing where characters from Victorian fiction, from different novels, from pulp and from you know, Dickens and Hardy and from Polidori's vampire novels and whatever, will all interact in a shared world. And we want writers to write these stories where all the characters overlap. The good thing is that the public will also be able to influence what happens in the stories. And so-and-so's interested and so-and-so's interested and Alan Moore's interested as well. And I thought, well, I bet he isn't, because that's basically something that Alan Moore's already written, that story. He wrote a lot of comics where characters from, for want of a better word, highbrow Victorian fiction interacted with people from pulp fiction. And so I rang him up and he said, that's funny, because I didn't want to do it, but they told me you were. And they thought that would make me want to do it, because I know you. And he said, when the alarm bells rang for me, he said, was when they said to me, the characters must be visioned in such a way as the public can influence the development of the story. He said, you have to be specific. You have to be suspicious, he said, when what they're asking you to do is so dodgy they've had to invent a new verb to cover it. And he said, at the end of the day, he said, I'm a writer, and one of the only nice things about being a writer is I get to decide what happens to the characters. I don't hand it over to the public. He said, what would have happened to Little Dorrit if Dickens had had to put it to a public vote? But there's the thing, I think, is more difficult now because things that look like opportunities, right, you could showcase your work on a, you could make a YouTube clip of it, you could do that, actually in a way complicate it. Because it depends what the final point that you're working towards is. So I don't know what a way forward is for someone who would find themselves in the position that I am now. But then it is very encouraging to hear that Dan, for example, literally wrote to Marvel Comics and said, I've been writing these comics, and then got a job. There is a kind of assumption that you'll need to like do something devious or clever or mad, but sometimes it's still there's still a proper channel that may still work. I hope that was the same as last time, but with an extra bit on the end, because I'm much older now, much wiser and more philosophical. Okay, are there any questions? All right, great, thank you very much. Thanks a lot.